Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 25th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio will be Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times and WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And we'll hear from WCAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Deehan as they talk some Statehouse news. We start off with something a little bit different this week. We're going to begin with Josh Balling on Nantucket. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, volunteers turned out last Friday and Saturday to rescue stranded scallops. This was a result of the big, powerful storms that we had.
They were. Last Thursday's northwest winds blew about 300 bushels of scallops or more, scallops, scallop seed, and nubs onto the shore in Wawinet, primarily in Nantucket Harbor. Eelgrass was piled about 3 feet high, and those scallops, young scallops and adult shellfish, were strewn all over the beach for quite some distance. And about 30 commercial scallopers, some members of the town's Natural Resources Department staff, and community volunteers alike were out there both Friday and Saturday scooping up the scallops into fish totes, loading them into boats, and depositing them back in the deeper waters off Pocomo.
How unusual is this?
It hasn't happened in about a decade, but it's not completely unheard of. When we have these big northwest storms, the scallops, especially this time of year, they will, to some degree, bounce along the bottom of the harbor, and they will get washed up on the shore. About a decade or so ago, there was a major stranding, much bigger than this one, when a good number of scallops were put back into the harbor. The problem is that the strandings haven't just been a factor of the storm, but a harbinger of a problem that's been plaguing the fishery for a while now, and that's the decline in the eelgrass. Scallops tend to cling to eelgrass to avoid bottom-feeding predators like crabs and to avoid being swept ashore in storms. And when you have these kind of strandings and scallops washing up, it tends to mean that there is not as much eelgrass in the harbor, and less eelgrass probably means less scallops. And with Nantucket's dwindling scallop population, only about 3,000 bushels were harvested last year, and that's the lowest that anyone can remember. That's not a good sign when you've got the commercial scalloping season coming up starting on November 1st.
And recreational scalloping season is already open, is that right?
Recreational scalloping season is underway. It started on October 1st, sort of the reports from recreational have been a mixed bag. Those who have their spots have been collecting quite a few scallops to bring to the table, and others say that it's a longer haul to get enough to have for dinner. Generally, recreational scalloping, family scalloping, is not an indicator of commercial scalloping. Recreational scallopers go out, for the most part, in water that's waist deep or less. Some may snorkel for them, and the commercial scallopers go out into much deeper water and harvest with dredges. So it could be a factor of where the scallops are in the harbor, but we'll just have to wait and see until the end of next week to find out what the commercial season is shaping up to look like.
We've got another story this week about how the town is exploring ways to ensure public beach access. Tell us about this.
Well, Nantucket has had a long tradition of private property owners allowing access to the water and letting people use their beaches to walk from one spot to another, more so than in a lot of communities on the Cape and other beachfront communities in Massachusetts and even Martha's Vineyard. But the debate over who owns the beaches and if the public has the actual right to walk along the water has been waged for decades, and it came up again last week. The select board voted to explore possible amendments to local bylaws that would assert public access up to the mean high water mark along the coastline and also establish some regulations as to when dogs are allowed on beaches in an effort really to ensure public access. It came up most recently again due to an issue that began this summer. A beachfront property owner in Matticat put no trespassing signs along his beach and extended ropes down to the low tide mark that have since been removed, but the message was basically the same, that his land is private, not open to the public to walk along, especially with unleashed dogs. He said that in too many instances in recent years, those who have been using his property have abused it. They've let their dogs run unleashed on his property. They have, he said, people yell at him about letting them use their beaches. He says it's his property and he's tired of it. But town officials say Nantucket is all about its beaches. It's what drives the economy here, and there has to be a happy medium while still respecting private property rights that people can have access to the beach and use the beach along the waterline to walk from one place to another.
I want to talk about one other story you had this week, which is about the Steamship Authority raising its fares. It's going to use a peak pricing model next year, and this is something new for the ferry service.
This is something new for the ferry service, not new at all in most parts of the transportation sector. Airlines have been doing it for years. Hotels do it. But the Steamship Authority hasn't done it before. The rates do go up in the summer, but they're the same any day of the week. And next year, that's going to change. The boat line's going to charge more per vehicle on the weekends, high-demand days in the summer, than it does on the other days of the week, starting when you make your reservations January 1st. Boatline officials said it's a way to one way among a number of other rate hikes to address some increases in costs, primarily some maintenance costs to both terminals and vessels, to payroll, to healthcare costs, and they feel that doing it this way really takes some of the burden off the year-round residents of the islands. The similar fares are going to be in place on the Vineyard as well. Takes the burden off residents of the islands and those who travel in the off-season, as well as maybe spreading some of the traffic out a little bit. Those people who might not have to get to the island on a Friday or a Saturday may decide to bring their cars over, their vehicles over on a different day, and that will ease the burden a little bit on those high peak days, they hope. But Nantucket's peak fares now in the summer will be $250 to $275 each way, depending on vehicle size, Friday through Sunday, and $230 to $255 Monday through Thursday during the summer months from May to September. One of the benefits to year-round residents, however, is what they call the excursion fare. If you're a year-round resident, you get a round-trip residence-only rate, which is currently about $165 to $275, depending on the size of the vehicle and the time of the year, and that's only going to increase $5. Again, SSA officials saying that they're doing what they can to ease the burden as much as possible on the year-round residents while still balancing their books and making their budget.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We're going to speak right now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Hey, it was good to hear Josh on the air. You know, Nantucket is going to lose to Martha's Vineyard this weekend in football, so that's
good. I'm going to have to give Josh equal airtime now on that. George, the Martha's Vineyard Film Festival is backing out of a deal to purchase land from the Martha's Vineyard Agricultural Society. We talked about this deal some while back when it was first coming together. Tell us what's happened here.
Yeah, this seemed like the perfect match for the film festival, the Ag Society, and Polly Hill Arboretum. The Film Society was going to buy about 10 acres of land and have a new home. They've, of course, rented space in Chilmark for years at the community center, but this would give them a permanent home. And, you know, people seem to like this idea, and it seemed to be going on behind the scenes. And then all of a sudden, on Friday, to their membership, the Film Society said they were backing out of the deal, and with not a lot of other information in there about what went wrong. And our reporter Rich Salzberg tried for days to get to the bottom of this and finally did speak to Steve Bernier, who was the president of the film festival. He stepped down in part because of this deal falling through. He was disappointed in the founder of the film festival, Thomas Benna, pursuing a different piece of land, about 53 acres on North Road and State Road, that Bernier says isn't as good of a site for the film festival. He described the Ag Society land as a storybook deal, and he really thought that was the best move for the film festival to find this permanent home. You know, he said with all good conscience he couldn't support the direction that Baina was taking. We have not heard from him, Thomas Baina, about this. He did not return our messages seeking comment on this. But it is interesting that there was this all going on behind the scenes, this drama, so to speak.
I want to ask you about another story. Oak Bluffs looking at renovating its town hall, and this comes after a plan to build a new town hall fell apart.
Yeah, you can almost write this script for any public project on the island. You know, they get estimates, they go forward, ask taxpayers for a certain amount of money, and then they're not able to get bids that equal that amount. And that's what happened with the Oak Bluffs project. They secured the funding from voters, both at town meeting and then at a town election. And then when they got bids in, it came in much higher than what they had allotted on two separate occasions. They did try to go back to voters to get the additional money, and voters said no. So now what they're trying to do in Oak Bluffs is to see if they can renovate the existing town hall. And so they did bring in an architect who came up with four concepts for them, you know, and they're very fluid at this point, presented those to selectmen. Selectmen saw enough good in those that they've agreed to go forward with a more structured design that they can then go back to voters with and say, what do you think of this? You know, one of the discouraging things about this is renovating this building is going to cost almost as much as it would have cost to build a new building. And that seems to always be the case with projects, you know, because of the fact you never know what you're going to find. Mm-hmm. With an existing building, what, you know, you have to build in even more contingencies as a result of that. And just construction continues to go up. And, you know, this project has now been delayed a year and a half. And, you know, by the time they get the support of voters in the spring and then put it out to bid again, you know, who knows what the price, final price tag will be. But the town is definitely in need of additional space for its town offices and some upgrades as well.
It's George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Stephen. Go Vineyarders.
Go Vineyarders, go Nantucket. And joining us right now in the studio is WCAI's lead reporter, Sarah Mises-Tallion. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Sarah, you were out at the Mass Maritime Academy in Buzzards Bay yesterday for the unveiling of a first-in-the-nation facility. Tell us what this was about.
Sure, yeah. Like you said, Governor Charlie Baker came down to Buzzards Bay yesterday and was very proud to unveil the very first offshore wind training platform. We got to be careful about how we phrase it, but an offshore wind training platform, the very first in the nation. It basically looks kind of like a ladder attached to a platform. It's all about 10 feet tall and all sits at the end of a very long gangway, just a little bit offshore. It's in deep enough water to simulate, you know, ocean going conditions with the wind and the choppy water, but you can walk out to it or you can take a very small boat just from the shore.
And then part of the idea here is that they're training potential workers in the offshore wind industry how to get on and off a platform in the middle of the open water.
Yeah, turbine experts say that's one of the most dangerous transitions is when a turbine technician goes out to the turbine and they have to disembark from their vessel and get onto the offshore wind platform and then climb up a ladder and actually get into the turbine to be able to do work. Or they may take an elevator up from that platform into the actual head of the turbine. But either way, they say that's one of the most dangerous transitions on the job, and it is a key part of safety training if you want to be an offshore wind technician. And so they say this test platform will be able to have the Mass Maritime Academy actually train up recruits with hands-on training.
Now, the state has invested heavily in promoting the offshore wind industry, and it's also put a good amount of money into this very particular training site. Yesterday, we heard a lot of talk about jobs. That's what's really behind all this.
Yeah, the platform cost $1.7 million from the state, so it's not cheap. You know, I think the state is really hoping that by building this training platform, it is the only place in the United States that if you want to be an offshore wind technician, you would essentially have to go to Buzzards Bay at this point to be able to get that safety training to become one. And so they hope that this will really plant the flag as Massachusetts becoming one of the epicenters for the burgeoning offshore wind industry.
We call it the burgeoning offshore wind industry, but we don't have an industrial scale offshore wind farm yet. And there was talk that it was supposed the ground was supposed to be broken, so to speak, before the end of this year. That's not happening now with Vineyard Wind. What does the industry look like? What's happening?
Of course, yeah. So, you know, Massachusetts was on track to have the very first offshore wind farm in the country, commercial scale. Of course, Vineyard Wind, that was supposed to be south of Martha's Vineyard, and that hit a bunch of federal hurdles this past summer. And there hasn't really been much word in terms of how much they're going to progress past this point. The feds basically said, we need to re-examine how this offshore wind farm and other offshore wind farms are going to affect the fishing industry in the area and kind of just close the book on that for a little bit. And so, you know, Massachusetts may be in a bit of a tenuous spot. The state still wants to continue to push on building the industry here and really trying to plant more flags to say, yes, we are still open for business. They say they're still going to be soliciting another 800 megawatts in the next few weeks for another offshore wind farm. And they say they're also going to be looking for plots of ocean for another 1,600 megawatts in the next year. So they are still moving forward as fast as they can on their end.
WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. When we're going to the break now, when we come back, we're going to speak with Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us in the studio right now from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Gwen, fascinating story this week out of the State House. Two off-Cape legislators filed proposals essentially to weaken the Cape Cod Commission, and it appears that they did this on behalf of a developer.
Yes, and this has been going on. You know, we had two stories on this week. The first one explained, laid out the idea that legislators acting on behalf of a developer named Lasade said that what they did mm-hmm. first is they filed legislation attached to the governor's budget, which would limit the discretionary referral clause. What that does, that clause, is, you know, automatically the regional planning group, the Cape Cod Commission, is activated for anything that's 10,000 square feet or above. But for the discretionary, that allows towns who have concerns to also refer projects that are smaller than that. They can go ahead and do that. And what this would do, had it gone through, would have been to eliminate discretionary referral and basically open it up to any project. It could be, you know, 9,999 square feet, but it would still, you know, there would be no way for the town to have any input in terms of getting it to the commission for a DRI review, you know. District of Regional Influence.
Impact.
Right,
influence,
impact. No, I think you're right.
Impact. So it's one of the things that really caught people's attention here is that all of this was proposed by legislators who have no connection, apparently, with the Cape.
They're from Central Mass.
Districts from Central Massachusetts.
Gardner,
right.
And right next to it, Fitchburg. You know, so it's like out of the blue. And you know, I think there was a certain sense of outrage, like, why are these folks proposing legislation that would affect the Cape? Senator Julian Sear spoke with the state senator who had introduced this legislation, and he said he was doing it on behalf of a constituent. And that's where the developer, strip mall developer, Lasade, came in. He's actually got a proposal pending for a dollar store complex in Eastham. So they were trying to do an end run around the Cape Cod Commission and the town's ability to file with them.
Julian Sear and really the whole delegation got quite upset about this, as you can imagine, and really called out the other state senators on this.
Yes, later in the week when it was first of all, the Cape representatives in general blocked it in the House. And then when it came before the Senate, Julian Sear launched an impassioned speech. I think this was just yesterday, and it's in today's paper. And he talked about the fact that this was, first of all, not only do we want, you know, people from Central Mass making laws for the Cape, but that this was also something to beware of because it wasn't an insulated incident. He called it a one-off. It was not a one-off. He thinks it's part of a statewide effort to open up the Cape in ways we may not want it opened up in.
And he really pointed at the efforts of pointing to a number of specific examples of people with money and influence attempting to make an end around some of the regulations that are, you know, standing in the way of development across the Cape or trying to protect the environment across the Cape.
This was one of the strongest responses from the Cape delegation that we've seen.
And Vinny DiMacedo, who also serves there in the state Senate representing the Cape District, really stood up right after Julian Cyr and said kind of essentially what he said, that he said that really Julian had put it nicely and that it's important for people off Cape to realize the pressures that the Cape is under right now all the time from development.
Absolutely. And they pointed out, too, that the Cape is not just another area of Massachusetts. It has specific environmental concerns, which is why they have a regional planning body.
November is just around the corner, Gwen, but public health officials are saying that the threat from triple E-infected mosquitoes isn't over just yet.
No, you still need those long sleeves and long pants and insect repellent because...
It's a little easier to wear long sleeves as it gets cooler, yes.
That's true. I see you're wearing a scarf.
It's cold in our studio.
But I found this kind of interesting. Not being a gardener, I don't know this, but now I do. It takes 4 hours of temperatures below 28 degrees to reach the hard frost that will kill off virtually all the mosquitoes. And we haven't had that yet, so there's still some hardy souls out there, and they may be carrying triple E.
There are specific areas on the Cape that were categorized as moderate risk. Remind us where those are.
That's Bourne, Mashpee, Falmouth, Truro, and Wellfleet are categorized, as you said, as areas of moderate risk since infected mosquito pools were found there. And the rest of Barnstable County is low risk.
This has been such a harsh season, really, for triple E. I mean, it's been, for many people, it's been the biggest uptick in triple E that we can remember. There have been cases reported across the state. How many cases have we seen so far, and what kind of impact has it had?
Well, the numbers have really tell a story here, because between 2009 and 2018, there were a total of 10 human cases of triple E, Eastern equine encephalitis. We're calling it by the easier name here. But then in the last 3 months, there have been 12 human cases confirmed statewide. And that number has not been reached in a single year since 1956, according to state statistics.
And one of the really scary things about this disease is that it has a very high fatality rate, and it can really make you very sick.
It can.
I know that... I was interested in this article by Christine Legere in the Cape Cod Times. She points out that a lot of the reason that we're experiencing this in Massachusetts has to do with habitat, and that we have these cedar swamps that are freshwater hardwood swamps, and that's the habitat that these mosquitoes really like to breed in.
Yep, that actually came from the Centers for Disease Control that were looking at why this area is hit and why the state is.
And the response this year, as people will remember, we had the spraying within villages, which has never really happened on Cape before. And in the meantime, the mosquito control projects has really worked hard to get into these areas and put in larvicide to kill the mosquito larvae. And so far, there has not been a reported case of triple E on Cape Cod.
It certainly is true that some of the bigger venues that, you know, like Carver's slightly off Cape, but they also did additional spraying because they have an outside venue with lots of woods.
The utility company Eversource has wrapped up its yearly effort to clear weeds and brush from beneath power lines. It's an effort that has drawn a lot of criticism over time and continues to do so for its use of herbicides.
I was admiring how you went from spraying to spraying.
Yeah. A different kind of spraying.
Actually, this is true. Eversource was able to complete its yearly treatment of weeds and brush under the power lines at 8 Barnstable County towns this fall before the window for getting the tests done closed. And that's according to Reed Lamberty, the utility spokesman.
Tell us, remind us which towns now they're dealing with here. They did get to some of the towns, but not all of them. What did they get to?
They did treatment in Barnstable, Harwich, Chatham, Bourne, Sandwich, Dennis, Yarmouth, and Falmouth. And that treatment wrapped up on Monday. Mr. Reed was pointing out that, I'm sorry, Lamberty was pointing out that there was a different kind of spraying. You know, it was done from backpacks as opposed to a general truck spraying, which is more widely broadcast. And perhaps the most, one of the most important things that he mentioned is that there was no glyphosate used this year. That's a product in an herbicide called Rodeo, and it's been historically applied.
It's the type of herbicide that was a red flag for many people. And the real concern here is that the herbicide may make its way into the water table. Cape Cod has a single source aquifer, and if that gets somehow contaminated, then you're really poisoning the Cape's water supply.
That is. And there's also concerns about that particular ingredient being on the list of possible carcinogens.
The folks who have been advocating against this, Eversource, of course, points to the fact that this has been labeled as safe for use, and that this is completely considered a safe use for how to clear the power line rights of way. The folks who have been advocating against this and who have been advocating to move away from herbicides were not particularly happy that even though it sounded like Eversource didn't use the glyphosate this year, these folks were still not terribly happy with how it went.
They had raised some concerns about notification. And we're talking about Laura Kelly's organization and also Susan Phelan from the director of Green Cape. They were concerned about the spraying being done without people really being, now, I mean, we don't know if anyone was aware, but without their groups and without many of the neighbors being aware. And, you know, in terms of those concerns, State Senator Julian Sear, who is a Democrat from Truro, has sponsored a bill that would give cities and towns authority to restrict the use of harmful pesticides, so including glyphosate. But
that bill is sort of still up at the State House somewhere?
It is. It's before the Joint Committee on Environmental the Joint Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture. And there's a hearing coming up on November 12th if people are interested in the issue.
Over the weekend, we learned that Jim Crocker, who was the sitting president for Barnstable Town Council, had died. A lot of folks have been speaking out about his life and about what he meant to the community.
I think it came as a shock to a lot of people, but he died just a week ago today, late Friday afternoon at a Boston hospital. And his death was announced by Council Vice President John Flores. Jeff Spillane spoke to several people in the community who worked with Crocker and who were familiar with his work. He was the town council president. He was also the owner of Wiano Realty, and on the council he represented Precinct 5. The words that people said, it was interesting because they shared some common attributes, mm-hmm. and I thought that this is something from once again Julian Sear. He's in the news a lot this week, but I thought it really summed up Mr. Crocker's personality. He called him a quote profoundly decent person, and that's, when you think about all the town government that we cover, that seems like a really fitting epitaph, you know?
He also said he leaves quite a legacy in Barnstable and across Cape Cod. Jim Crocker was a 14th generation Cape Codder, which is quite a statement, quite a testament to his connection to this place, I think.
And I also wanted to mention that, you know, sadly, he was only 62, and he is survived by a wife and two daughters.
There's a list of some of the things that he was involved in around the community that's quite a testament to how much energy he brought to the region, for sure. Things like he was in not only in the Osterville Village Association, but he was involved in the Historical Museum, and he was a parish council chairman at Our Lady of the Assumption Church, and he was also involved in the youth football programs and the female hockey programs. and State Representative Tim Whalen saying just that it's incredibly sad and that he was a man of high integrity and great intelligence, says Timothy Whalen.
It's interesting, as you read this list of things he was involved in, many of them have to do with that that native Cape Codder you know, history and that comes, you know, from his being here such a long time with his family.
There was a wake on Wednesday, and the funeral was held yesterday for Jim Crocker. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times has been Gwen Frisk. Gwen, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having us, Steve.
We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, where we are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us right now from the Provincetown Independent is Casey Myers. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Casey, how are you?
I'm good, too.
You've got an article this week about small groceries closing on or around the Outer Cape and the impact this has had. Tell us a little bit about this.
Sure. You may not know this, Steve, but the Wellfleet Cumberland Farms is closing next month for the winter because the store is being rebuilt and enlarged. And that means it's going to be like the Donner Party out here after 7 p.m. when the Wellfleet Marketplace closes. And I'm exaggerating a little, but the fact is five small grocery stores on the Outer Cape have closed in the past few seasons. These include the Bradford Natural Food Store in Provincetown, Phoenix Fruit in Orleans, Nauset Market in East Ham, Soul Food Natural Food Market in Wellfleet, and the South Wellfleet General Store. And so that means technically East Ham and Wellfleet are considered food deserts of sorts, meaning they have a shortage of healthy options. And towns like ours suffer disproportionately from high rates of obesity, diabetes, and other diet-related diseases, and we also don't get the economic benefit that large grocery stores can provide. In other words, it's really hard to buy vegetables at the last minute in our towns. And Elspeth?
Okay, I think that we lost Casey there. We're going to try to get her back. And we are going to check in right now at the State House. Healthcare has been a big topic of discussion this week as lawmakers digest Governor Baker's new priority to lower healthcare costs, which was released just before a big two-day meeting on this very issue. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about this and other pending legislation on Beacon Hill.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
The governor kind of dropped his new health care bill at an odd time, at least to members of the press. It was Friday afternoon last week. We often kind of think of that as, you know, when stories drop, they're hoping they get buried. But this is a really big deal. Talk about what the governor wants to do.
Yeah, I think the timing of Baker's bill last week was to really get ahead of this big meeting that was held this week, which was the Health Policy Commission's annual hearings and analysis of health cost trends. Basically, they take a look at if cost spending is going up, and it had been. Actually, overall cost spending was about on pace, on benchmark. However, consumer spending, out-of-pocket costs had been going up. So I think Baker's bill, he wanted to get that out ahead of the bad news, so to speak, so that he would have a plan in place. The bill would essentially force healthcare providers, big hospital chains, etc., to spend more on behavioral and primary healthcare. You know, things like more regular visits, therapeutic treatments, good habits. That could really equate to fewer emergency room visits and fewer developed diseases down the road. Baker says that will likely lower costs and kind of incentivize these providers to have more proactive care. As the population gets older and more chronic issues are going to be a shift in our healthcare market.
So you mentioned this health policy big meeting. It was a two-day meeting this week, and lawmakers were there, including both leaders in the House and Senate. What did they have to say about the numbers?
they're on board. I think that the legislative leaders know that they failed to pass a bill 2 years ago that was supposed to be a health care cost containment measure. That failed at the last minute. The House and the Senate could not make a compromise, and that bill died, and it hasn't gone anywhere for 2 years. You know, flash forward 2 years, and health care costs are creeping up. I think that they probably think that they bear some responsibility for that, and now is the time to get a bill moving. I spoke to both Speaker DeLeo and Senate President Spilka about where they stand on that, and they said that they will have a bill ready to go next year sometime.
Have previous cost control efforts failed to keep these spending rates down? There's been so much talk over the last few years about cost controls and whether or not they're going to work.
Yeah, and again, you know, the two-year time period is interesting because that's when the legislature's cost containment bill died, like I said, before the end of last session. So, you know, Democrats had plans to help out community hospitals. That was really a main part of this bill that didn't go anywhere. And honestly, it's been kind of radio silence from lawmakers over that last 2 years. They've concentrated on other issues like education funding, things like that. But, you know, since they failed to pass that bill, a lot of talk has been on Baker's side. What's the governor's plan? We're going to wait for the governor's bill. And that's exactly what we got last week, was the governor putting forward a pretty solid plan that both Democratic leaders support a lot of. So I think that will definitely be a major starting point for when the legislature, both chambers, kind of take up the issue late this year or early next.
I want to turn now to some other news. This actually happened late Wednesday night. House lawmakers passed their version of a $1.5 billion education funding bill. The Senate passed theirs already, and they had some changes in it. How about in the House? Does it differ much from the Senate version?
The House version hews much closer to that original agreement between Senate President Spilka and Speaker DeLeo about how to fund K-12 schools at the district level. It was a unique kind of thing where the chambers, the House and the Senate, agreed beforehand on the parameters of the bill before it was debated in each individual chamber. So, you know, stay with me here. What happened then was, so they have a bargain, they have a deal. The Senate altered that a little bit when they brought the bill to the floor. They put in an amendment that was, you know, preferred by teachers' unions that would give, as they would put it, accountability at the district level. What it does is it kind of de-emphasizes the power that state regulators would have to withhold funding from school districts that are deemed underperforming. Teachers' unions and the Senate would prefer that authority to be at the district level, not at the state level. That is a change the Senate made. Now, the House did not make that same change. So when this bill goes into one of these six-member conference committees, the panel that will decide the final version of the bill that gets put on Governor Baker's desk, they're going to have to reconcile that difference. And it's a pretty big difference, especially because Baker has said that that is the part of the bill that interests him the most. He wants more state oversight over this $1.5 billion that's going to be kind of pumped into the school system. So this is something that lawmakers are going to have to decide. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen at the drop dead point when the session ends next summer. It really remains to be seen. So keep an eye on those secret meetings that they have.
And finally, just briefly, the House passed a surplus spending bill last week, and the Senate took up their version this week. Lawmakers always add bills and amendments into budget bills. Will those end up slowing down this process of getting the surplus budget passed?
Yeah, this is the supplemental budget. It closes out fiscal year 2019, even though we're already into 2020. This is kind of a closing of the books, so to speak, on an accounting level. And there is a surplus, money to be spent. Therefore, the legislature needs to divvy it up. And so it's not just spending that's in here. There's a lot of what's called outside sections, and that's different kinds of policy and lawmaking that kind of get crammed into a budget bill. A budget bill, of course, has to pass. So there is a lot of incentive to get little nuggets of policy into these types of budgets. One thing that the House was doing was making some changes to tax law to reflect changes made on the federal level in 2017. And that's all very complicated, but it boils down to some changes to corporate tax law that the Senate wants to slow walk through the committee process. So once again, we're going to have an example of the House and Senate passing differing versions of these bills and needing to reconcile in the conference committee before it can go forward and get signed by the governor.
And that's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Boston. Mike, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Great to be with you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean at the State House. We're joined now by Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the parent-teacher organization at Harwich Elementary School is behind an effort to replace the school's playground. Tell us about this.
Sure. Yesterday, members of the Board of Selectmen and the school department, as well as some of the people from the PTO, took a tour of the Castle in the Clouds, as it's known, playground at the elementary school in Harwich. And they all pretty much agreed that the structure is beyond its useful life. And last night, the school committee voted to close it down. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are sad to see that happen. This is the playground's been around for 25 years. But the wooden structure has really seen better days. It's 5 years beyond its expected life expectancy. And it really hasn't been maintained as well as it should have. The PTO formed a playground committee last year, and they did a safety audit, and they found that there were numerous health and safety violations, as well as noncompliance with accessibility laws and codes, which are really critical these days, of course. The PTO has filed an application with the for community preservation funding to replace the playground with a more modern play structure that complies with current regulations. And I think most importantly, won't give kids splinters. That's been one of the major problems with this structure. Last year, the school department said that 165 kids had to go to the school nurse because they had received splinters. That's a lot of kids.
It's a lot of kids. The replacement of this structure, it's a big ticket item.
It is. They've estimated the cost at about $681,000. And so far, the PTO has raised about $40,000, and they're asking the CPA for about $641,000. Now, the selectmen want to have a say in this because actually the playground is on town property. So the town is going to want to be part of the process. And actually the selectmen are expected to vote Monday to ask the DPW to demolish the structure to get it away so it won't be a sort of a attractive nuisance to kids. What they're saying now is that there's going to be a little bit of back and forth on the cost, and they're going to look at the design, and they're going to see if they can bring those costs down. And kind of further complicating is that the community preservation group tells us that they've got a lot of applications this year, so the competition for funding is going to be a bit tight.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
We're going to go back now to Casey Myers and try to complete our conversation about what's happening up there with small groceries closing on the Outer Cape. Hi, Casey. You there with us now?
Yes, I am. That's been an interesting morning, huh?
It's been a bit of a whirlwind, Casey. Thanks for being part of it. Listen, I want to pick up where we left off, which is that these small groceries are closing, and it has a big impact for people living on the Cape. And there's a number of different factors involved with why this is happening.
Right, exactly. So the main issue is economics. Of course, it's very hard to support vegetables and other fresh produce when you're trying to when you don't have the volume that you do. So Keith Altheus, who with his wife is the owner of the Salty Market in North Truro, they're closing for the winter for the first time. And he was talking about how the new Super Cumbies in Eastham was probably not good for the Nauset market in Eastham, because Cumbies has a genuine lunch rush, he says, and the cheapness of the convenience store is appealing for people in the winter.
This is the Cumberland stores, Farms, just for people who aren't familiar with Cumbies as a shorthand there.
Oh, you're right. Sorry, of course. anyway, he says it's so appealing to be able to go there and buy with their prices. But local stores like his can't even try to compete. And there's also the value of the real estate. Elspeth Hay, who wrote the story, noted that the Phoenix Market at 14 Cove Road in Orleans, that lot has since been developed with 7 townhouses, and each are listed for nearly $800,000. And then there's one last factor, which is cannabis.
I was so interested to read this, that the cannabis market there has had an impact on the small grocery world.
Exactly. The South Wellfleet General Store, at which closed, and the Soulfold Natural Market on Bank Street in Wellfleet, which also closed, were both going to become marijuana shops. The tenant at the South Wellfleet location has since pulled out and is going elsewhere, but that's another factor. And yet, the growing of cannabis locally could, in a way, help support the growing of local vegetables, because if the local farmers at the Highcraft Dune Cooperative in Truro and Wellfleet, they're saying if they can get a good cash crop, it'll help them be able to grow the vegetables that we like. If only they could keep Cumberland Farms or convenience store hours, that would be even better.
It's a lot. You can understand why it's such a difficult puzzle to solve, how to preserve small markets on the Outer Cape with all these different factors at play.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, Cumberland Farms is going to close in November, and it's going to be a long winter out here.
That is Casey Myers from the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Take care.
And that is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank all my guests this morning. We heard from Josh Bowling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We spoke with Sarah Mises-Tan of WCAI, and we had Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times in the studio. We checked in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We heard from Catherine Ident and Mike Dean, and my apologies to Will Sennett of the Vineyard Gazette. We had some technical difficulties through the program today. Will didn't make it on. We'll get you back on soon. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.